morning is Selden versus Estate of Silverman. Mr. Bruno, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jason Bruno, here on behalf of the appellants who are known as the Arizona Seldens. We're here asking this court to vacate an arbitration award to the Omaha Seldens that awarded them over $5 million in damages on an investment they already made millions of dollars from, and another $1.1 million in attorney's fees, even though the separation agreement, the arbitration agreement, expressly prohibited an award of attorney's fees. The arbitration award also awarded the Omaha...
Mr. Bruno, how much time are you taking?
Me and Mr. McClay are going to split 7.5 and 7.5.
Okay.
And I'd like to reserve a minute for rebuttal, too, if I may. The arbitration award also awarded the Omaha Seldens over $3 million in rescissionary damages while still allowing them to keep their ownership interest in the investment and the benefits resulting from the investment. I'm going to be arguing two assignments, that the arbitration award results in a windfall and an impermissible double recovery to the Omaha Seldens in violation of Nebraska public policy, and that the arbitrator violated the separation agreement by awarding attorney's fees. Mr. McClay will be handling additional arguments if that's okay with the court. From a review of the largesse of the award, it looks like this investment, the Sky Financial investment, was a huge Ponzi scheme and a fraud. It wasn't. It is undisputed that the Omaha Seldens recouped every single penny of their investment back. They received distribution checks beginning in 2002, totaling $5.6 million. The Omaha Seldens also received the added benefit of $3.5 million from the lease and the ultimate profit on a sale of three of the restaurants involved in the Sky Financial investment. That was a unique benefit that no other investor achieved. All total, the Omaha Seldens received $9 million, not including the damages awarded to them by the arbitrator. The Omaha Seldens themselves calculated an annual 12.9% return on the investment. 15 years later, after my client brought claims to the arbitrator, the Omaha Seldens contended, well, this was a bad investment or we were somehow defrauded. Well, the Omaha Seldens needed to elect a remedy. The remedy they elected was rescission, which means they either need to be in the deal or out of the deal. They can't take the good without taking the bad. The Omaha Seldens elected rescission voluntarily, unconditionally, and irrevocably tendered their ownership interest during the arbitration to the arbitrator. The Omaha Seldens simultaneously represented that those ownership interests would never revert back to the Omaha Seldens. In fact, the Omaha Seldens represented that those ownership interests to effectuate the rescission and the benefits resulting therefrom, if any, would go to the Arizona Seldens. The arbitrator accepted the tender and eventually entered an award. The arbitrator awarded the Omaha Seldens $3.1 million in rescissionary damages consisting of the return of capital plus prejudgment interest. The arbitrator also reversed the irrevocable assignment and tendered the ownership interests back to the Omaha Seldens, not the Arizona Seldens as previously represented.
And is there any value to that ownership interest?
Significant value. In fact, since the arbitration, in an unprecedented and inexplicable move, the Omaha Seldens have filed third-party claims in the state of Arizona seeking $3.5 million solely as a result of the investment in Sky Financial. They also have an appeal pending before the Ninth Circuit, which they initiated essentially shortly after the arbitrator issued the award, where they're asking to bring a claim against the Arizona Seldens on behalf of the Sky Financial bankruptcy estate for $1.6 million. So it's clearly there's value.
Is this governed by the FAA?
The public policy argument, yes. It clearly is.
Well, does the FAA apply to this case?
Yes, we believe it does.
And so what grounds are you moving under the FAA statutes to seek a vacator of the arbitration?
The material miscalculation shown from the face of the award, which is a valid ground, and violation of public policy, which as this court has determined in the Henderson case.
Henderson was not an FAA case.
It
correct?
Was not, but the Henderson case didn't limit its language or its holding simply to the to arbitrations in general. I think it applied to everything. And then if you look...
Hasn't the U.S. Supreme Court had something to say about what are the possible bases for vacation of a arbitration award governed by the FAA? Wall Street case?
They have, but as the case law determined, even the Elger case, as noted by the district court below, has found that public policy is a valid ground under the FAA to vacate an arbitration award. And when you think about it, it's logical, because what did the Omaha Seldins do in this case? They came in to the Nebraska state courts and said, hey, we want to have this as a judgment that we could enforce in your state. If this was something, if the arbitrator said, well, okay, you could enslave people or you could marry multiple people at once, this court wouldn't sit there and say, well, that's not a valid ground under the FAA. This court would say, no, that's against our public policy. You can't use our courts to enforce this. And we think that's the holding in the guise of Henderson and the Garlock case thereafter.
What specifically is the public policy that you want this court to enforce?
There's three. Windfall. This reward clearly equates to a windfall in favor of the Omaha Seldins. They didn't put on any significant evidence or any evidence of damages. In fact, they said we couldn't calculate damages because they are speculative, and they told the arbitrator we don't need damages as an element to prove our claim. That's number one. The second one is a windfall. Nebraska has a public policy against windfall.
One.
Oh, I'm sorry. Double recovery, which is kind of synonymous. And the third one is there needs to be an election of remedies. They are all basically related and all the same. The reality is Omaha Seldin's got a double recovery here that's about, or they're trying to turn into a triple recovery or more by still using the ownership interest that they forfeited and disclaimed as an element to their claim for damages for rescission.
How are your arguments any different than an argument than that the arbitrator made an error of law?
Because they're significantly different, because the arbitrator could make an error of law, but not that one that impacts Nebraska public policy. I mean, we're not complaining about the merits of the arbitrator's decision, just the calculation of his award. The Omaha Seldins can't have their cake and eat it too. They either needed to be out of the Sky Financial deal or in the Sky Financial deal and return to the status quo as if the deal never happened. That's not what happened here. They were awarded damages as owners of $1.9 million, and then on top of that, they were ordered rescissionary damages of $3.1 million. But now, even though they prevailed in arbitration, are asking this court to confirm that, they're in another court asking for $3.5 million of damages. Well, they were supposed to have been made whole by the arbitrator, and that's exactly why they forfeited and tended their interest. And that is completely against Nebraska public policy in this case.
Mr. Bruno,
yes.
I'm having a hard time with the limits of this concept of public policy. It seems like you're just enunciating rules of law and saying they're, each of them is a public policy. Can you help me in that way?
Well, it's difficult because they're similar, but they're not the same. I mean, they're clearly violations of law that the arbitrator engaged in, but the problem here is the windfall argument and the double recovery, which are against Nebraska public policy. That's why Nebraska doesn't award punitive damages. That's why the Nebraska doesn't allow attorney's fees except in certain circumstances. So with that, I don't want to eat into Mr. McClay's time, so if the court has any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But we're asking the court to vacate the award because it violates Nebraska public policy and because of the attorney fee award, which is inconsistent with the actual language of the separation agreement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. McClay, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Bart McClay and I represent Scott Seldin individually. I'm going to try to address two issues, the arbitrator ownership issue as well as Scott Seldin's joint and several liability. The arbitrator ownership issue really goes to the heart of our justice system. If this case had involved an actual judge taking ownership of the property during a proceeding, I submit the reversal of this appeal would be immediate and firm. In Nebraska, the result is the same because of the law that this court has established. Scott bargained for Nebraska law.
Counsel,
yes.
In the judge context in state court, wouldn't a judge order that the clerk take custodial ledges of that as part of the court official? I'm a little troubled with your analogy there. In the arbitration context, you have an arbitrator. I don't know that much about it. Do you have a clerk that could take possession of it?
You have an available clerk, and that would be at the district court. The separation agreement actually had for a procedure that if you couldn't do it in arbitration, Section 9.3 of the agreement said you can use a procedure of the court, take the property down and have it interpled in the court, and that issue resolved, and the arbitrator doesn't get in the conflicting position of taking actual ownership. This court has numerous times said that under Nebraska law, the judges and arbitrators' ethical standards are the same. And you've declared in State v. Patineau that an arbitrator neutrality issue is in fact an ethical issue. Going even a step further, the statutes, the arbitrator disqualification statute itself refers to the judicial disqualification statute, which says specifically, before a judge can take an interest in a case, there must be a writing, and that writing must be signed by the party and made a part of the record. That didn't happen here.
Did the parties agree to this process?
The arbitrator, when the issue came up, counsel went forward. It was a surprise to everybody in the room, and they said, we want you, the arbitrator, to take ownership. The arbitrator was surprised and said, why do you want me to do this? They then said, well, we're doing this irrevocably, and you can treat it as an interpleader. So he reframed the issue, that is, the arbitrator, okay, well, I can treat this as an interpleader, and the property is never going back to them. They asked the counsel involved, and he said, well, would that be acceptable? And he said, yes. But here's the problem. The ownership issue became an albatross for this particular arbitrator. He realized that this was a problem. And how can he award double damages in this way? How can he give them the damages they want in this circumstance? And here's why we know that. We know it because he didn't simply return the piece of paper or tear it up. He took the extraordinary move of putting in an award, which I have never seen in 35 years of practice, any judge or arbitrator at any time doing a transfer of personal ownership of the property in dispute in an award and transferring it to the party that had given to him in order to give an award. And the reason we know he was concerned about it is because he took that step. Your Honor, if a litigant had come to you and said, I'm going to give you a piece of paper and say, I'm transferring to you the Brooklyn Bridge, you might politely hand the piece of paper back to them, you might tear them up, but you would never think to go to the New York Register of Deeds and say, I am not an owner and I'm disclaiming. What he did here was take that step because it was concerned. He didn't want to be in the chain of title. He held that property for 7 months, over a year end. What are the tax consequences? This property was in a bankruptcy court. What's the notice that may have to be given to the bankruptcy court? This was a security. Do I have to give any notice to the SEC? These were complicating factors, and our position is simple. If even for one moment an arbitrator or a judge passes through their mind this idea that they have an ownership issue, that award, that judgment must be vacated. We can't have the person in charge of the tribunal being in a position of compromise, and that's what happened here.
What kind of protest did you make when this was done?
Your Honor, we did not, when it was raised, we said it was acceptable to the arbitrator accepting an interpleader. We didn't know. He had dismissed. He had reframed the issue of his own ownership, which he raised, to being something else. I want to raise with you a case that came out just a few weeks ago. It was on October 22nd. We've told last week the opposing counsel about this case. And in that case, it was Monster Energy versus the City of City Beverages. And in that case, it was the Ninth Circuit case. It was
Site on that case?
It's so new, we don't have a specific site. It's a Ninth Circuit case. And in that particular case, it was a JAMS arbitrator. And that arbitrator had said, I have an economic interest in the overall part of JAMS. That's what he said. Nobody objected to the arbitrator. Then it became found out that he was an owner of JAMS, and the Ninth Circuit vacated that award and said ownership is a crucial issue and always has to be concerned. And the reality didn't match there did not match the facts. And that's the same thing that happened to Scott in particular here, who had no dog in the fight at the time this issue arose. He was a stranger to it because he had been told he has no securities liability. And that goes to the joint and several argument that's been raised, and we briefed on that. He did not have any liability. But this was this particular case, the Monster Energy case, said ownership is too important. And that's what we'd say here. I'll leave the last for my few seconds remaining for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr.
McElhaney.
McElhaney.
Yes, it's not an easy one.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Sean McElhaney. May it please the court. I'm Sean McElhaney of Bryan Cave. I have with me today co-counsel Robert Lepp of McGill, Gottsteiner, Warner Lepp firm. We represent the Omaha Seldons, who are appellees and cross-appellants today. The Omaha Seldons asked this court for three things, essentially. Number one, to affirm the district court's May 3 judgment and order sustaining the Omaha Seldon's motion to confirm a final arbitration award. Second, we ask the court to affirm the district court's May 3, 2018 order and judgment awarding the Omaha Seldon's their attorney's fees as a sanction against the Arizona Seldon's for their frivolous opposition to the confirmation process, for taking what should have been a simple procedure and turning it, as the district court said, into a literal relitigation of the arbitration itself. And third, our cross appeal, we merely ask the court to have the judgment properly reflect what was rendered in the district court's award on May 3, 2018, which is not properly reflected in the February 28, 2019 order due to, and I'll reference language that this court used in Eicher ruling on a nunk-pro-tunk issue regarding an accidental citation. And the accidental citation in this situation was to Exhibit 54A only, which sets forth the McGill-Gottsteiner firm's fees, rather than both Exhibit 54A and Exhibit 57, where Exhibit 57 sets forth the Bryan Cave fees. I will begin with the first two issues. The first two issues relate to the sustaining the motion to confirm and the awarding of attorney's fees as a sanction. The United States Supreme Court has told us that this review begins in evaluating the judicial confirmation of an arbitration award under the Federal Arbitration Act under sections 9 and 10, and this is in Hall Street. It says, sections 10 and 11 are the exclusive remedies upon which an arbitration award may be vacated or modified. The Eighth Circuit also has stated in its 2010 case, Medicine Shop, it held non-statutory vacatur standards are no longer available after Hall Street. The Eighth Circuit also said in Brotherhood of Maintenance in 2002 that judicial review of an arbitration award is among the narrowest known to the law. And finally, as the United States Supreme Court stated in MISCO, courts do not sit to hear claims of factual or legal error by an arbitrator, as an appellate court does in reviewing decisions of lower courts. However, that is exactly what Arizona, the appellants here, asked the district court to do in raising no less than 15 issues, each of which attempt to relitigate factual and legal issues that the parties fully briefed and argued in the arbitration and that the arbitrator decided upon in no less than 55 pages of awards and 140 paragraphs. Even a cursory review of the governing law should have dissuaded Arizona from attacking the final award in light of the extremely deferential applicable standard. But Arizona's motion to vacate, its several applications related to 5 of the 12 interim awards, and its opposition to Omaha's motion to confirm, do nothing more than attack the arbitrator's factual findings and legal rulings. The district court's February 28, 2019 order at page 8 finds exactly this. The court, in referring to its May 3, 2018 order states, "The order repeatedly identified the absence of rational, factual, or legal basis to support respondents' theories of modifying or vacating the final award. The order found that respondents failed to explain how the transfer of the Sky Financial securities to the arbitrator relates in any way to whether the arbitrator actually committed misconduct, and while ostensibly moving under the misconduct prong of Section 10A3, respondents cite to no authority addressing an arbitrator's misconduct." The district court's award also states, "The court found respondents' positions were not credible, legally mischaracterized, fundamentally misplaced, and repeatedly misleading, finding respondents' explicit consent to the tender procedure, which we've heard about here today, belies their present claim that the action by the arbitrator was astonishing and surreal." The order goes on to say, "Respondents mischaracterized the significance of the relation back under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 15. Respondents' argument is fundamentally misplaced because they have not identified any mathematical error in the calculation of prejudgment interest under the final award."
And counsel, is there a double recovery, or does it not matter?
Oh, it may or may not matter, and I think that's an excellent question, in that many of the things that we hear both in the briefs and in argument I would characterize as Arizona's conclusory premise. In this situation, we have the conclusory premise of a double recovery. Indeed, it is not a double recovery. You have separate injuries. The first one is an Arizona Securities Act fraud, whereby the Omaha Seldon's interests and ownership interests were diverted into a security ownership without adequate disclosure. That is a separate and distinct injury from a corporate opportunity theft. And the corporate opportunity theft occurred when Millard Seldon, who is among the Arizona Seldons.
So the $3.1 million was for the alleged violations of the securities law.
That is correct.
And the other is $1.9 or something for the opportunities lost.
That is correct. And they are separate and distinct injuries. In reality, when we look at this issue, this is yet another situation where if you look beyond the premise that they conclusively state that there's a double recovery, and you look at what they're actually arguing, they're simply relitigating an issue that they litigated before the arbitrator. They argue to the arbitrator that these two recoveries are legally inconsistent principles. The arbitrator decided that they are not, that they are indeed separate injuries. And so what we have is, again, them attempting to relitigate today what they've already lost before the district court and on, candidly, several times before the arbitrator. And that is also true when we talk about the concept of ownership. Just because the Arizona Seldons conclusively state the premise of ownership, it doesn't mean that ownership was conveyed. It is important to look at the record to see whether or not there is any support for the concept of ownership. And we begin that process by looking at the assignment that was actually tendered. And I have prepared an actual chart there that might have some assistance to the court to understand the transaction, to understand why we went through the process of seeking damages in the way that we did. And they refer to it as rescissory damages. And the rescissory damages are different than rescission because, in effect, the concept of tender is rendered impossible. And if I might briefly step here and bring this.
Can counsel see?
I think we can. Yes.
Thank you.
What happened is that, can you hear me from here, or do you want me to speak from there?
Speak loudly.
I will. On the top left-hand corner, you can see that SD&M and MTS owned 34 parcels of real property upon which there were Pizza Hut restaurants. The fraud occurred when Arizona diverted those real property interests to an entity called Sky Ventures. And in exchange for that, Sky Ventures gave an ownership interest in itself to Sky Financial, and then Sky Financial ownership interest, what SD&M and MTS received in return were Sky Securities. So when we got to the point of the arbitration, and we have Omaha versus Arizona, and there was the concept of tendering, the only party to whom we could have tendered was Arizona. However, if we had tendered our security interest
to Arizona, they could not have returned the 34 parcels of real property that had already been diverted to Sky Ventures. And by the time the arbitration had been initiated, Sky Financial had sold its ownership interest in Sky Ventures. So there was no way to effectuate a rescission in the typical fashion. So what resulted from that
is the inability to tender. At the liability hearing, which was the June 2016 hearing, the issue of tender was raised as a defense. It was fully litigated, and it was the defense was denied. Unfortunately, in their pre-damages arbitration hearing, Arizona again raised the issue of tender. We were compelled, because if you don't tender during the trial, it is deemed too late, and so we necessarily had to do something to address this issue. Otherwise, we created the risk of losing a multi-million dollar award, particularly in light of the fact that the security interest had very little, if any, value. So what we did was to essentially say, arbitrator, here is a procedure that wasn't defined specifically as an interpleader, but akin to an interpleader of sorts if you look at the record. And the assignment in that interpleader says to the arbitrator, excuse me, to Eugene Commander as arbitrator, not individually, conveying no personal interest to him, but as an officer of that arbitration proceeding. And as was asked earlier here today, doesn't the judge not actually take control of it, but it's given to the clerk? In the same fashion, this arbitrator didn't hold on to that assignment. He didn't take it home with him. He didn't possess it at his own. As reflected in CMO 61, Case Management Order 61 in the arbitration, it's reflected that though that assignment was marked as an exhibit in the arbitration proceeding and made a matter of record and held by the court reporter throughout. And so he never had physical possession of that assignment. And at some point in time, he did order, when he decided on our side that tender was impossible for this reason, he gave the order to return the assignment to us. Given the extraordinarily litigious nature of the parties here, the arbitrator did include language that was probably very cautious and very conservative to ensure that there'd be no suggestion that there was any interest or some contention to that point. Maybe a different way to focus on this issue of ownership would be to focus on what actually creates the risk. We heard about Monster Energy today, a new Ninth Circuit case, and that brings to the point of the pecuniary interest. The arbitrator revealed the issue was that the arbitrator failed to reveal his pecuniary interest in JAMS. Not just that he worked for JAMS or did a lot of arbitrations for Monster Energy, but he did not disclose to the party that he actually gained by virtue of the fact that Monster Energy brought all of its arbitrations to JAMS. Here we don't have that. We don't have anything in the record that suggests that the arbitrator had any pecuniary interest. There's nothing in the record, there's not even an argument made where they contend that by virtue of the outcome of this arbitration, the arbitrator gained or lost something. So he had nothing at stake. If I can turn in my last couple of minutes to our cross appeal. In our cross appeal, we raise two issues. First, an assignment of error that the fees awarded are insufficient. Our argument here is simple and relies upon the Court of Appeals decision in Ray versus 30 LLC, which we quoted in our brief at page 73. And in the court, in discussing abuse of discretion and the relative expertise of a trial court and a court of appeals to evaluate attorney's fees, the Court of Appeals states that an appellate court will interfere only to correct a patent injustice. The district court's August 26, 2019 ruling, which was on the nunk-pro-tunk order, makes clear that the court intended to award fees, not only those in Exhibit 54A, but also those in 57, and have Omaha deprived of those fees because of the district court's admitted inadvertence is a patent injustice that this court can correct. We also raise the issue of the nunk-pro-tunk order. Much of the discussion in the cases revolves around whether or not a judgment can be increased or enlarged. And I think that begins to touch on the right issues. But where that happens is where, for example, you have a grant of easement, and then the nunk-pro-tunk order adjusts the final judgment to add a quiet title action. That's not what we have. As this court held in Luz, In Re Luz P, the purpose of a nunk-pro-tunk order is to correct a clerical error or formal errors and to make the record correctly reflect the judgment actually rendered. Judge Durr's May 3, 2018 order awarded the Omaha Seldens the fees they incurred in opposing the frivolous, in dealing with the Arizona Seldens' frivolous opposition.
So we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars here.
We are, but it's but just as this court did in Eicher in addressing an attorney's fees issue, it was upheld because the judge had mistakenly cited to the UDPA as opposed to the CPA. It is a simple mistaken reference, and the same thing occurred here. We had a mistaken reference to only 54A and not to both 57 and 54A, and we think that is the type of error that can be corrected. It's merely clerical and ministerial and can be corrected on a nunk-pro-tunk order. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
There is 12 seconds, Your Honor.
I'll use a wiper.
Okay, Mr. McClain.
Your Honor, the Omaha Seldens are asking this court to be the first court in the nation to allow an arbitrator or judge to take actual ownership. Think about the next case. What if it's about a sports car or a summer home and they interplead the property for the benefit of the arbitrator? This has so much place for abuse and mischief. This court needs to have a clear rule. That's why the statute is the way it is. 24739 says you must have a writing and it must be on the record. That way this court or any appeals court would know themselves clearly there was a waiver. We represent clients, not lawyers. These rules are a benefit of the clients, so make sure they understand. Thank you, Your Honors. I see my time is up.
Thank you very much. And do we have more rebuttal time?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Sorry, Mr. Bruno.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That takes us then to the next case of the day, which is Dick versus Kosky Professional Group, PC.